was Oscar Wilde who observed, and would no doubt be gratified by its enduring quotability, observed that there is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about. He spoke as a man whose life was a study in being the subject of conversation. He spoke as a dandy. For the dandy looking swell, perhaps with wit to match, was a way of life. And the influence of that movement of dandyism reaches far beyond mere fashion and conversation, as Dominic James discovers in his latest book, British Dandies, Engendering Scandal and Fashioning a Nation. Dominic is Professor of Modern History at Keele University, and he joins us. Dominic, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The idea of the dandy, it sort of rolls off the tongue, but do we truly understand in general conversation what that means?
Yeah, well, I mean, the term is bandied around a lot nowadays, as it was 200 years ago when it was first coined. And some people use it as a very kind of dismissive phrase, saying that someone is basically a bit superficial, a bit narcissistic, maybe a bit full of themselves. You know, who do they think they are? Whereas other people use it in a slightly different way to say, oh, look at that person over there. Wow, they've got a certain something, they've got a certain style, which is not just about trying to look good, but also to be very much an individual.
It is that thing, is it not, of standing out from the crowd? There's a sense of quiet elitism in the notion of being a dandy.
Yes, that's part of the controversial quality to it. And that, I think, connects with our kind of love-hate relationship with individualism. On the one hand, we really like to think that we are individuals, there's something special about us as particular people. On the other hand, we tend to prickle a bit at the thought that someone is kind of setting themselves up above us. And that's one of the reasons why the figure of the dandy is controversial, looked up to on one level and kind of sneered at the same time.
How did this begin?
Well, there are people called dandies in Britain and in various places that speak English. There are, of course, people who are also doing forms of dandyism in lots of other cultures and lots of other languages, but mine is a case study, basically, of the British style of dandy. The word actually comes into widespread use at the end of the 18th century during the period of the Napoleonic Wars, at a time when military uniforms were terribly fashionable and to have well-cut clothes and suits was important. But in the book, I also talk about a prehistory of the dandy, which goes back at least through the 18th century into the 17th century. And it really originates from a kind of contestation between more puritanical, moralistic people who thought that one should try to look plain and godly, and more, shall we say, self-assertive, flamboyant people who thought you should try and use style to stand out in society.
Is there a point of departure in this, and perhaps it comes to a rise of people outside of the traditional aristocracy, a point of departure from where fashion is a thing which is a strict line of descending impersonation from the king or queen on down?
Really, really great question. Because the other thing about dandyism is that it's not just about wearing a uniform or following an individual fashion. It's also about creating your own fashion in a way. It's a little bit about being individualistic, as we were saying. And if you go back to times like the Renaissance through the 17th century, a lot of fashion was about court culture and royal courts in Europe, and was often set literally by the king or queen and their retinue. And so if you wanted to kind of get ahead in society, you looked to see what the royal family was up to, and you basically elegantly copied it. And this is one of the arguments about where the widespread wearing of wigs actually came from, because courtiers started copying king's practice wearing a wig in France. Now, in Britain, after the period of the civil wars in the mid-17th century, the monarchy was restored, but it was a monarchy that had to kind of assert its difference from the France where it had been in exile, so that people wouldn't just say, oh, come on, you know, this is the door by which France is going to take us over. And literally, Charles II decided that he was going to have a different style of dress. It's not a dress he picks, is actually something slightly exotic. It's a sort of precursor of the current business suit, rather than something called doublet and hose, which was the Renaissance style, which is basically a short jacket and then what we might think of as rather sort of poofy, rounded shorts. And this, what was billed as a kind of plainer style using good British materials, for example, woolen cloth rather than imported French silk, is actually established in Britain. And it is quite new. It's quite radical. It's actually ultimately suggested to be based on Indian costume and pajama suits. And partly, I think, because it's a new style, various of the rich people, because it does take money to have clothes made for yourself, start to experiment with it. And you get plainer and more elaborate versions of this. And so the precursor debates about dandyism are all about how plain or how ornamented these very early precursors of the gentleman's suit should be.
Is it in this period that we see the rise of the macaroni, which is always...
They're great.
I'm always attracted by the name, if nothing else.
Actually, that's very important in the 18th century, which is where we are in relation to these dandies who are known as macaronis. I mean, the reality for most people in the 17th, 18th centuries, if in doubt, they probably didn't have enough to eat. And so fussing around about precisely what style statements you were going to make by the food you, the kind of food you eat, just like the kind of clothes you wear, well, that's a bit of a statement of status in itself. So the macaronis, they were a type of dandy who were characterized by their taste for Italian culture. And of course, macaroni is basically pasta. So what happened is that the youth of well-off families, not necessarily just aristocrats, but you need to have a certain amount of money to carry this off, would be sent on something called the Grand Tour. And what it basically is a journey down through France into Italy in the Mediterranean. You were meant to spend a few months there. Mm. And the idea was sort of that you'd pick up a kind of polishing in classical culture, because this is a period
ruins
when,
and the like.
Yeah, you'd sketch ruins, you'd sit around with a tutor reading Latin poetry and all this kind of stuff. Now, at that time, this was regarded as the height of intellectual sophistication, because the Greek and Roman classics were still prized as a kind of cornerstone of knowledge. Now, in fact, when you were down there in Italy, I think quite a few of the young gentlemen spent their time drinking, perhaps even whoring, and generally misbehaving themselves and partying, basically. They come back to Britain and they picked up foreign tastes. And these involve things like perhaps wanting Italian food, like pasta, and dressing in more French-influenced fashions. If in doubt, a lot of those French fashions were a bit more flamboyant than the British ones, with their slightly more toned-down precursor of the suit. So these young men arrive in London, they're dressed up in the height of French fashion, literally the height, because some of their wigs were noted as being ostentatiously tall.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, describe that rig. What are these gentlemen wearing?
So, I mean, the main thing you need to think about is, I remember reading this terrifically titled academic article. Most academic articles have very long titles, but this one was just called Big Hair. So the crucial thing about macaroni's wig style was big and tall. So the wig is built upwards. The hair is then carried down at the back with a huge lump of it tied up into a big bag. It's called a bag wig. And the macaroni style specifically was provided with a small hat that sat somewhere a long way up the top of this wig, rather like a modern style fascinator. So the overall approach would have been quite spectacular. Now, you could decide what you thought this looked like. On the one hand, you could think, wow, what a tall, magnificent figure of a man. The effect is a little bit like these British soldiers with their kind of hair hats, these busbies that they wear, make them look tall and scary in theory. Or you could have a look at this and think, well, I'm terribly sorry, but you look absolutely ridiculous. And a lot of people in Britain then attacked this macaroni style as not looking swish and fabulous, but actually looking, frankly, they didn't use this term, but basically camp and what they called effeminate.
And how much of the effeminizing of these styles, is this often an expression of sexual preference in some of these adaptations?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So one of the grounds on which dandies were attacked, and what I really want to emphasize here is it wasn't just like, you know, the back page of the menswear supplement where this was debated. These were things that were debated on the equivalent of the front page of the newspapers when it was asked whether prominent influential figures and politicians were or were not macaronis or dandies. One of the things that happens is that there's a long-lasting tradition in Britain from the 17th century of trying to call out dressy men as being self-obsessed. And of course, if you're self-obsessed, you're not actually very obsessed with the ladies. Now, that kind of accusation starts to drift through the later part of the 18th century. And one of the things that drives it is a series of public scandals and legal cases where gentlemen of fashion, as they were called, were sometimes implicated in sodomy trials. Mm. Now, the word homosexual hadn't been invented yet. It's invented in the 19th century. But people certainly did know about unnatural sex because the act of sodomy, which could be basically anal sex between two men, or it could actually be anal sex between a man and a woman, or it could be with an animal, was a capital crime. So what happens in the newspapers is that we get lots of increasingly unsubtle innuendo associating certain macaronis with sodomy, basically. And this is where the Italian connection comes in. So I'm not making any comment on what Brits or French people or Italians are really like, but there was a kind of proto-homophobic feeling in Britain that Britons were somehow morally more secure than other lesser nations, and that in particular, Roman Catholic countries were prone to what they termed sodomitical vice. And the reason for this is that Roman Catholicism, unlike British Protestantism, required that priests remain unmarried. And so there was a suspicion that these unmarried men were getting up to dubious things. So the suggestion is that macaronis and dandies who went down to France and Italy were picking up, how can I put this, not just a taste for macaroni, but a taste for rather spicier things as well.
Rigatoni as well. I mean,
absolutely. Ravioli stuffed with who knows what.
This notion, though, that the style that can suggest the behaviour. I mean, Oscar Wilde himself, in his court case where he's being tried over sodomy, it makes the point that I'm being tried not so much for the act as giving the appearance of one who might engage in it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In the 19th century, we have a period when being dandified becomes ever more visually kind of spectacular and ever more debated. This is the period of the Regency dandies and the figure, for example, of Beau Brummel. In the later 19th century, we have some very famous people, including Oscar Wilde, who very self-consciously looked back to some of the dandy styles of a century earlier and experimented both with dressing up in a spectacular way, but sometimes also dressing down in a spectacular way. Mm. But Wilde himself was often called out for posing as something. And that's one of the things that he self-consciously talks about, because one of the things about Wilde is that he was, unlike a lot of the previous dandies, he was an intellectual, so he liked to theorize about these things. And a lot of his theories were about the significance of, I suppose, what nowadays people would talk about as performance or performativity. In other words, you are who you appear to be, which was quite a radical statement at the time, because a lot of people believed that people were somehow inherently sort of good or bad, and they had an inner truth. But at the same time, they also sort of believed that you could tell someone's character by their face. Those two things aren't easily compatible, and Wilde was kind of poking around and having fun with that.
I'm thinking it's entirely possible, Dominic, that that young man serving me my coffee with his impeccably trimmed beard, his carefully chosen tattoos, his wonderfully arranged, slightly retro clothing may have a hint of the dandy about him.
Right. I mean, that's really interesting. One of the other questions that ties into that, you mentioned the young man, is also the question of kind of what about women? And can women be dandies? And that actually was something that was debated quite hotly through the whole period of the book. And some people said, yes, of course they can. Everyone can, because it's a style of being careful about your clothing.
Yep.
But in fact, other people came back and said, well, no, not really. And the reason here is a bit of a kind of sexist division, which is that through most of the kind of European past over the last few centuries, women have been expected to be interested in fashion and to spend a lot of the time looking at themselves and thinking about clothes. Whereas men, on average, have been thought to distinguish themselves by not spending so much time on those things. That's one of the reasons why dandies were called out for being effeminate, because supposedly spending a lot of time carefully selecting what you're going to look like could be argued to be acting like a woman.
I think there is an entirely separate conversation beginning there, Dominic, but we must contain ourselves, I'm afraid, because of time. The book.
Sure.
The book is British Dandies, Engendering Scandal and Fashioning a Nation. Its author is Dominic James. Dominic, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. I mean, I clearly, as you can tell, am fascinated by this. I'm reserving questions about whether I too am a dandy for another conversation. I think it's an endlessly fascinating topic.
British Dandies, it's available in shops and libraries, and Dominic is Professor of Modern History at Keele University. And this is Blueprint, Radio National.